there's no exceptions for partial releases of records when it's coming to identities of victims.
The governor's office denies APRN's records request related to sexual abuse in the Alaska National Guard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 30th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the U.S. prepares to take a bigger role in guiding change in the Arctic.
Holy cow, we have got to be careful as a world on how this is developed.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at FNBAlaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Maryland tax collectors had good news for Republican Senate candidate Dan Sullivan today, and perhaps bad news for his campaign. Maryland authorities say he doesn't have to repay about $5,000 in homestead tax credits he received from 2006 to 2008 for a home Sullivan owned in Bethesda. Only owners claiming a home as their principal residence are entitled to the credits. The bad news for Sullivan, at least politically, is that Maryland authorities announced in an email today they've concluded Sullivan and his wife were residents of Maryland at the time. Democrats have for months been making an issue of Sullivan's Alaska residency. Zach Fields, a spokesman for the Alaska Democratic Party, said today Sullivan hasn't been straight with Alaskans.
It's clear at this point that he's been dishonest on the campaign trail because his official declaration of candidacy says he's a 17-year resident of Alaska. And he and his spokesman have said that he's been a resident of Alaska since 1997.
The Sullivan campaign issued a written statement saying, among other things, that a person can be a resident for tax purposes while remaining a citizen of another state. Campaign spokesman Mike Anderson says the Sullivans lived in Maryland temporarily while Dan Sullivan worked at the White House and the State Department, but they always intended to return to Alaska. Maryland authorities started looking into Sullivan's tax credits after getting a letter from the chairman of the Alaska Democratic Party. Maryland Taxation Director Robert Young said in an email today the conclusion the credits were properly granted relied on, quote, confidential information that may not be publicly disclosed under Maryland law. Sullivan's opponent, Senator Mark Begich, pays taxes to the District of Columbia for a house he owns on Capitol Hill, as does Alaska's senior senator, Lisa Murkowski. Neither of them, according to property tax records, claim the homestead credit D.C. grants to its residents. In April, it was reported that Governor Sean Parnell's top staffer used his personal email account to communicate with National Guard whistleblowers about sexual assault response. In an interview with APRN that month, the governor said Chief of Staff Mike Nizek's correspondence on the National Guard should be a matter of public record.
I've asked Mr. Nizek to check his personal email for that, and his recollection is that it was one email account that they emailed to him. But again, that was, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. So I've asked him to check that account, move it to the state account, which is the protocol we're to follow. And that'll be, you know, part of the public record at that point.
Shortly after, APRN filed a records request to learn how the Office of the Governor handled complaints about the Guard. 4 months later, that request has been denied. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
Alaska regulations give government bodies 10 working days to fulfill a records request, plus another 10 if they need an extension. It took Parnell's office 86 working days just to deny one. The request sought any emails Chief of Staff Mike Nizek sent to National Guardsmen using his personal account from 2010 on, among other things. APRN asked for these documents to find out how the governor's office responded to complaints about the National Guard from its own members. Did they respond efficiently, and did they take complaints seriously? Since the request was filed, APRN put in more than 24 calls to the governor's office to find out when the request would be satisfied, many of which went unreturned. The response finally came in as a 3-page letter that arrived on Friday, September 26 at 6 p.m. The denial letter cites the legal right to privacy and references a recent attack ad by Senator Mark Begich's campaign that upset the family members of sexual assault victims. It also suggests the documents fall under privileges protecting personnel and the communications of clergymen. Governor Parnell was aware of the request, but not of its denial. After a Monday debate in Juneau, Parnell did not say if he believed records related to the National Guard should be made public, and instead repeatedly referred questions to his policy director before telling a reporter she wasn't serious in her questions.
I've known about the request, but I've not reviewed any records. I don't know what he has done, so... We will comply with the statute to the best of our abilities, and that's why I suggest you go see and ask Randy Ruaro.
So that's what we did. First, Ruaro apologizes for the slow response.
That is a long period, I agree.
Ruaro says they were swamped with requests and lacked manpower to deal with them. He says there was no political calculation behind the delay and that there was no effort to avoid potential litigation over the request being processed before Election Day. As far as the denial itself, Ruaro says he took a broad view when he opted to reject the request wholesale instead of partially fulfilling it or releasing redacted documents.
There's no exceptions for partial releases of records when it's coming to identities of victims, their circumstances, personnel records. The statutes just don't say in those instances that you can release part of a record, but not all of it. As I read it, they're more of a blanket prohibition.
Parnell's political rival disagrees with that legal interpretation. Bill Walker, an attorney who is running as an independent candidate for governor, questions some of the reasons for the denial, specifically the argument that the correspondence with National Guard chaplains who raise concerns about leadership should be excluded.
They're trying to apply a privilege that doesn't apply to them. Those chaplains are not the clergy for Mike Magic and John Parnell.
Walker adds that if he were governor, his interpretation of the public records statute would make transparency a higher priority. He suggests the governor is stonewalling and that the point of the delay is...
Keep the issue out of the public eye. Cannot expose the governor's wrongdoing until after the election.
The chaplains who notified the governor's office of wrongdoing within the National Guard declined interview requests or did not respond to messages. But their attorney, Wayne Ross, says he's disappointed Parnell is not providing more information about his office's response to the allegations.
I think you ought to hold his feet to the fire and get him. Obviously, if he said it would be released and it's not being released, somebody's not following his orders or he's not being truthful. I would like to believe that somebody not following his orders.
While the governor's office did not provide any records, APRN was separately able to obtain 3 emails sent by a National Guard chaplain, along with 1 response sent by Nizek from his personal account. The emails were sent at the beginning of 2012. And the chaplain's correspondence refers to the sexual assault crisis only broadly. The chaplain does not identify victims, but he does name specific Alaska National Guard leaders and proceeds to excoriate them. The chaplain mentions the, quote, misuse of a government credit card to the tune of over $200,000 and the promotion of a senior officer who ignored the problem of sexual assault in his command. On a 3rd message sent February 3rd, the chaplain expresses concern that he's, quote, cluttering up Nizek's email. The email reads, just so you know, I am receiving your messages. I got a call wanting me to send an acknowledgement. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an ancient tool helps carve a new building in Juneau.
It roughs and shapes and chops and digs and chews.
Stay with us.
The Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Federal health officials announced today that the first case of Ebola has been diagnosed in the U.S. in Texas. The patient, who traveled from Liberia, is being treated in isolation at a hospital in Dallas. The director of the Centers for Disease Control says he has no doubt that the disease will be stopped in its tracks in the United States. Still, public health officials in Alaska are prepared to respond to Ebola if it arrives in the state. Michael Cooper is the Infectious Disease Program Manager with the state's Division of Public Health. He says Alaska is making sure everyone at every level is ready for a potential case of Ebola. But he says because the state has few people with roots in West African countries, Alaska isn't likely to see a case of the disease.
Our risk is exceptionally low. Just it's harder to get here, and then we have sort of a base of fewer people that either have ties there that are from there or that are going over there to work and then coming back to Alaska.
Cooper says even though the risk is low, the state is taking extensive precautions. The Division of Public Health has issued health alerts and is ensuring that any healthcare worker or airline worker who could be involved in responding to Ebola will know what to do.
We're making sure that no matter if it's, you know, today or in 3 months, if somebody comes and they fit certain criteria, they were over there, they had a high-risk exposure, they have certain symptoms, that everyone that they might come into contact with within Alaska, you know, has this as, you know, high index of suspicion, and they know what to do quickly. They know who to call very quickly.
Cooper says if a patient is diagnosed with Ebola in Alaska, the disease could be quickly contained. That's because Ebola can only be transmitted through bodily fluids. The Ebola outbreak has killed more than 3,000 people across West Africa in countries that lack basic public health infrastructure. The Arctic is changing, and the United States has a chance to guide more of that change when it assumes the chairmanship of the Arctic Council next year. Today in Washington, D.C., Arctic experts and policymakers gathered at the Center for Strategic and International Studies to focus on what the U.S. might do with a new leadership opportunity. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Recommendations ranged from the lofty to the concrete. David Hayes, recently the second highest ranking official at the Interior Department, made the case for better infrastructure planning. He says climate change and the fragile Arctic environment make it vital to choose the right locations for ports, oil wells, and other developments.
If we just go project by project, as we do tend to do in the United States today, we're going to make really bad decisions. That's what integrated Arctic management is all about, getting a science base and getting everyone together to make sound planning decisions going forward so we don't screw it up.
If the U.S. can coordinate that integration at home, he says it can carry the banner for the region. Hayes says it will take a lot of cooperation to prepare for the oil development that's coming to the Arctic Ocean in Russia, Greenland, and possibly the United States.
I went through the Gulf oil spill. I went through the Shell issues. And holy cow, we have got to be careful as a world on how this is developed.
Hayes says there's no infrastructure to support spill response and suggests it might be time to consider international governance for oil and gas rules. He also says the United States should use the chairmanship to promote renewable energy for Arctic communities that are now mostly dependent on expensive fuel. Combination wind and diesel generators have been successful in Alaska, and Hayes says now it's time to bring down the cost of the generators with standardized parts and better control systems.
This is an opportunity for the United States to use its technological leadership in renewable energy to bring to the world small-scale renewable options to replace diesel and to just show and to remind everyone that the Arctic is about people.
That was a common theme at the one-day conference. Arctic policy isn't just about conserving wildlife or exporting oil, but improving life for Arctic people. Alaskan speakers like Democratic legislator Bob Herron of Bethel says Alaskans should be included at every level of decision-making when it comes to Arctic policy.
We believe that Northerners are Arctic experts, and our advice should be inclusive. We should have that opportunity. We want it, and we're going to strive for it.
Meanwhile, Admiral Robert Papp, the State Department's special representative on the Arctic, says he's been searching for a way to make the Arctic a priority for the nation, the way putting a man on the moon was in the 1960s and building the Alaska Highway was in the 1940s.
What I have finally concluded is perhaps it's not defense or security related. Perhaps rather than a national imperative, what we have here is a moral imperative. We all have a responsibility, an obligation to protect this area of our Earth for future progress for the people that live there and to preserve this wonderful asset.
The U.S. assumes the chairmanship of the Arctic Council after Canada hosts its last meeting in late April. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Pacific walrus looking for places to rest in the absence of sea ice are coming to shore in record numbers on Alaska's northwest coast. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration confirms an estimated 35,000 walrus were photographed Saturday near Point Lay. That's about 700 miles northwest of Anchorage. The enormous gathering was spotted during NOAA's annual Arctic Marine Mammal Aerial Survey. The gathering of walrus on shore is a phenomenon that has accompanied the loss of summer sea ice as the climate has warmed. Walrus dive from sea ice to feed on snails and worms on the ocean floor.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, offering a wide range of equipment rentals from four locations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Soldotna, and Wasilla. CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
Anchorage's controversial labor law, commonly referred to as AO 37, will be on the ballot this November. The mayor and his administration want voters to vote yes to keep it. The municipal unions want voters to get rid of it. KSKA's Ann Hillman spoke with both sides and has this report.
AO 37 is called the Responsible Labor Law. The version that passed in 2013 and that the Assembly tried to repeal twice is 36 pages long. Tucked into the endless verbiage, deletions, and changes are four main points. Mayor Dan Sullivan says one of the goals of AO 37 is to make the municipality more efficient and save money by standardizing benefit packages, overtime pay, and holiday schedules.
And so when you've got department heads trying to manage a workforce, and that workforce has different holiday schedules, different definitions of overtime, different benefit packages, it gets to be really difficult and complicated to manage that workforce.
He says standardization makes the cost of union contracts more transparent to taxpayers as well, though all union contracts are already posted on the municipality's website. Another major change from the original 25-year-old labor law is the elimination of all pay incentives. Unions can no longer bargain for increased pay for specialized training or for earning a college degree. The mayor says the incentives don't provide any benefits to the city. Police Sergeant Gerard Aslin says those pay incentives aren't just bonuses. They're necessary for recruiting top-quality candidates to do things like join SWAT teams or develop critical thinking skills through higher education.
I would suggest to you that what we're doing is failing to recognize the additional work, responsibility, liability that people take on over and above the average job.
Aslin argues incentives are needed to balance quality of life issues, like being called to work on holidays. He says not all of the incentives are monetary. Which brings us to point three, management rights. Aslin says it's easier to work a dangerous 24/7 job, like being a cop, when you know you have a say in when you work. He says even though he knows he could get called out at any moment, Controlling his overall schedule gives him a way to balance work and home life. AO37 takes away that right and gives it to management. Sullivan says that's how it works in the private sector, and it should be the same in government.
What's the definition of management? You manage your workforce. What does managing your workforce mean? It means you decide what shifts, what schedules, who gets assigned what work at what time. That's what management does.
Sullivan says the decisions would stay with department heads. Aslan says previous and present administrations have tried to override department scheduling decisions. And finally, AO37 prohibits strikes and binding arbitration. If the administration and the unions can't reach an agreement during negotiations or mediation, an arbitrator will choose between the two sides' last best offers. Then the Anchorage Assembly will vote on it. Aslan says it's not fair to the employees.
Under AO37, it creates a structure where the municipality can start with something that's completely unreasonable, stick with it throughout the entire process, go to an arbitrator, and if a supermajority of the assembly doesn't approve it, it goes back to the management's last best offer. So there's no compelling interest to bargain in good faith when you know you hold all the cards, and in the end, you get exactly what you want.
Sullivan says the new process puts the decision into the hands of the locally elected assembly instead of an arbitrator from outside. He says Anchorage residents can vote assembly members out of office if they don't agree with their decisions. Those elections happen in April. The decision to vote AO37 on or off the books happens on November 4th. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Bethel Legislative Office was packed Monday afternoon for a hearing on Ballot Measure 2, a marijuana initiative that will appear on the November ballot. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
Elizabeth Lake came from Akiak by boat to testify. She said she was concerned that legalizing marijuana could create more social problems in a region that already struggles with high rates of issues associated with substance abuse.
People who smoke marijuana don't work, they're unemployed. If he has a craving for marijuana, he breaks into business so he can smoke and he ends up in jail.
The initiative would legalize, tax, and regulate recreational use of marijuana in Alaska for those 21 years and older. Charlene Egby, also known as reporter Charlo Green, now famous for quitting on air at Anchorage TV station KTVA to campaign for Ballot Measure 2, said she began using marijuana to stop abusing alcohol.
Hardcore alcoholic. I stopped drinking because I started smoking weed. And not only that, but my transcripts from college will show I went from failing out of the entire semester to staying on the dean's list.
Green flew in from Anchorage to attend the hearing in person. Anna Hoffman, the president and CEO of Bethel Native Corporation, testified against the initiative, saying she believes that marijuana can be addictive.
I've seen people in my community of Bethel. I've seen people in area villages and people in my own family prioritize marijuana over other basic needs. I have been in homes that are equipped with indoor plumbing, but these homes do not receive city water and sewer services. The children in these homes are not able to bathe or flush the toilet because that is not important. What is important in these homes is that even though there is no clean water, the parents are never without marijuana.
There were 14 testimonies at the Bethel hearing. No one from Bethel testified in favor of Ballot Measure 2. The final hearing is scheduled for Wednesday in Fairbanks. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Alaska Heritage Institute is incorporating a traditional native carving method into the building of the Walter Sobolev Center in Juneau. Wayne Price is a Tlingit carver from Haines. He's using an adze, a tool used by his ancestor thousands of years ago. KTOL's Lisa Fu has the story.
Like most construction projects, the building site of the Walter Sobolev Center in downtown Juneau is filled with modern power tools. But if you walk to one corner of the building, Tlingit carver Wayne Price has been texturing hundreds of board feet of red cedar using just one tool, an adze. To be more precise, it's an elbow adze that Price made himself.
The blade is made from a leaf spring out of a truck, and the handle is made from the branch of an alder tree, and it's held together by a string and a chunk of leather.
The handle is about 2 feet long, and he grips it with both hands as he chips the wood.
It's quite heavy. It's, I don't know, 3 pounds, maybe a little more. So it's pretty heavy to be swinging all day.
That's what Price has been doing. Since the beginning of September, Price has been adding red cedar board after red cedar board all day long.
I'm in pretty good shape right now.
The work he's doing on the board requires Price to read the wood.
And spot the knots and see the grain changes and be able to hit it and turn around and go the other way and keep all your adz rows all in a straight line.
With each swing, Price chips off a little piece of cedar, leaving behind a textured finish, the same seen on traditional Tlingit structures and pieces of art.
When my ancestors, oh so long ago, were able to make the first adz, that was the foundation that gave them the ability to make all the clan houses, all the totems, all the dugout canoes, all the masks, all the artwork.
Price says the adz is one of the foundations of Tlingit culture and something he's trying to keep alive. He started using one as a young man. Taught by master carver Nathan Jackson, Price adzed a clan house floor in Ketchikan. Since then, he's used the tool on a lot of his work, including 36 totem poles and 8 dugout canoes.
It roughs and shapes and chops and digs and chews all that material out of the way till we get to the hull of the ship.
For the Walter Sobolev Center, Price is adding 680 board feet of red cedar. They'll be used as columns surrounding the staircases of the 4-floor building. The Heritage Culture and Arts Center is scheduled to open in May.
I think if Walter's looking down, he would be smiling. He would be very supportive of an adventure like this. Something that's old and something that's new, being able to merge together to the benefit of all the people that are going to come for generations here, and be able to walk up the stairs and be able to see that each one of these marks was made one at a time.
As he chips away all day long, Price says he's brought back to the past. He sings native songs to the beat of the adz, as his ancestors watch over his shoulder, making sure he keeps his standards high. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Dacia Eaton in Bethel, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.